Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Dow is back above 14,000. The economy is adding jobs. What? Me worry? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday. It's the 1st of February. Good, as always, to have you with us. And come on, feels different, doesn't it? Dow 14,000. All right, no, not really. I know that. But it is as good a point of departure as any for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and a little bit beyond this week. For that, we've got Felix Salmon from Reuters, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, and our brand spanking new studios in New York City. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
It's beautiful here.
I know. It's so big, right?
It's enormous.
Felix, what do you think of the Dow? Should we give this 15 seconds and then move on?
Yes, please, because the Dow is a completely meaningless average. It's not even an index. It's an anachronism, and the fact that anyone pays any attention to it just never ceases to astonish me.
All right, Lee, you get 15 seconds. Go.
Look, come on, but we're talking, you know, this is an apples-to-apples comparison that we've been following forever, and it just hit a big record today. I mean, you know, I think there is meaning. For it. But I will say this. I mean, this is something that not everyone is partaking in. We are still living in a country that is a tale of two markets, economies, people, classes, everything.
And when you look at the Dow specifically, it's 30 big stocks. That's the only thing you're looking at.
Whatever happened to 15 seconds of moving on, Felix? Holy criminies. All right. So listen, let's actually move on to and this is a little bit the tale of those two economies that Lee was talking about. Unemployment came out today. Economy adding jobs, 157,000 of them last month. Nice. But the unemployment rate is up to 7.9%. Felix, what's your gut on unemployment and jobs?
It's steady. It's a steady move in the right direction, but it's going to take a very, very long time before we hit that 6.5% target that the Fed has. We all wish it would be faster. And frankly, given how successful all of corporate America is, as you can see from the stock market, wouldn't it be nice if they started hiring people with some of those profits?
That was kind of underwhelming, Lee. What do you think, right?
Yes. I mean, I think there's a lot to be taken that's positive from the number today. Specifically, the number of the long-term unemployed is going down quite dramatically, and that's a very important factor. And then there's that other thing that happens where the rate ticks slightly up when the people that are looking come back in and expand. So that is not a negative. It's a positive. But look, this is our issue going forward, and this is going to be our issue for a very long time. So we've got to learn how to deal with it, and we've got to learn about the impact that's going to happen that is not a result. You know, there are structural forces happening. Yeah. The labor market's changing. You know, there are a lot of people that might not have jobs in what they were doing before for forever. They might have to do something new.
Do you think we're ever going to get to 6.5%?
Well, let me actually frame the question, right? The chairman of the Fed said, 6 weeks, 2 months ago, that the Fed's going to keep on keeping interest rates low and doing what it can to help the economy until unemployment gets to 6.5%. At this rate, Felix, it's going to be like 2000 and never before that happens.
I'm not holding my breath. I think that 3 years is a reasonable expectation of when it will happen.
I'm sorry, 3 years from now?
From now.
Ugh.
And honestly, Lee has some good points. Like, you know, if we were in a European country, no one would expect to ever be able to reach 6.5%. And maybe we are turning European and we will literally never get there.
Lee?
I think we'll get to 6.5. I think there's a stronger argument to be made that 4 might be a thing of the past. And 4 was routine for a very long time.
Which it was for a long time, yeah.
Yes, for a very long time. So I do think, you know, we may be looking at a different kind of labor force.
All right. Cast your minds back farther in the week to the gross domestic product report from a couple of days ago, showing that the economy actually contracted. It shrank in the fourth quarter. Felix, does this number today kind of give lie to that contraction and just make it sort of statistical noise?
No, I think it's an important number, mostly to do with defense spending, honestly, because there's so much money being taken out of the defense industry that has an important impact on the economy as a whole. And it's important to remember that defense isn't just a boondoggle. It really does affect the economy.
Well, I think the other lesson there is that when we're talking about fiscal tightening, you know, it has an impact immediately. I mean, this was striking and unexpected. It actually outweighed a lot of other positives, but it was one thing and one thing only.
And worth a reminder that the deficit and the sequester, Felix, await in what, like a month?
Are we going to have a new Treasury Secretary by then? At the moment, we just have an acting secretary. Yeah. It would be really nice if there was someone in charge who you know, could knock some heads together and get the Congress to do what it has to do. But I fear we're going to get yet more brinkmanship.
All right. Last thing, and then we got to go. Lee, are you watching the Super Bowl this weekend for the ads or for the game?
All the ads.
Felix?
I'm not watching.
I knew you were going to say that. We were talking about it this morning, and I said, he's going to say he's not watching.
I'm English.
Felix Salmon from Reuters, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. You guys have a good weekend.
Thanks,
Kai. See you.
It was, as we talked about, a whiz-bang day in the equity markets. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's been a very small opening in the tyranny that the internet holds over our lives. It's a modest opening, to be sure, but one that offers hope, nonetheless. Okay, I exaggerate, but only a little bit. Ticketmaster, it turns out, is going to get rid of CAPTCHAs. Those are those little hard-to-read sequences of letters and numbers that you sometimes have to type in to make an online purchase or to go someplace. Seems, shockingly, those things have been turning shoppers off, as Sally Herships explains.
I could be a robot, so in order to assure you I'm not, I'm just going to fill out this little form, a CAPTCHA. In case you don't know, it's an acronym.
It actually stands for a completely automated public Turing test to tell computers and humans apart.
That's Tom Satwitz with Blink Interactive. He's an expert at helping companies make their websites more user-friendly, and you may have noticed he had a tiny slip of the tongue. He said Turning, but meant Turing, as in the scientist. We humans sometimes make errors, which is one of the catches of a CAPTCHA. If you don't get it right the first time, it gets harder the next.
People get annoyed, and oftentimes they'll just leave the site instead of making that purchase.
Whitney Hess is an independent website consultant, and that annoyance is why Ticketmaster says it's switching to shorter, easier CAPTCHAs. Instead of text, Ticketmaster customers will have to solve image puzzles. You might see a picture of a car, a flower, and a dog, and be asked to identify the animal.
This is something that is actually reasonably pleasant for the human being to go through, but again, something that is really difficult for computers to do.
Arun Sundarajan teaches digital strategy at NYU Stern School of Business. Because artificial intelligence is good at text, he predicts more companies will switch their CAPTCHAs to images. And according to Ticketmaster, the change to images will save you about 7 seconds. And that could help you score Beyonce tickets before they sell out. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
As we said up top, unemployment actually rose last month, 7.9% in January. But some parts of the country do seem to have figured out how to get the jobless rate down to more manageable levels. For the Federal Reserve, as Lee and Felix and I were talking about, that is 6.5%, 6.5%. So we sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman out to Boise, Idaho, to see what it's like to sit right at the Fed's unemployment sweet spot.
Boise sits in an idyllic river valley in southwestern Idaho, snow-capped mountains at the horizon. Nearly half of Idaho's population of 1.5 million lives in this remote corner of the state. Boise doesn't have oil fields or a lot of corporate headquarters or foreign car plants. What it's got is a little bit of this, a little bit of that. A big hospital and university, state government, tech firms, plus timber, ranching, and potato farming. And lately, you can hear this on the outskirts of town. The economy's got a pulse again. They're building single-family homes here, nice $300,000 ones with granite countertops, in subdivisions that were platted and plumbed, then went to weeds when housing went bust. Dave Checkitz works for Idaho Hardwood Flooring.
I'm making $16 an hour right now.
And what were you doing during the recession? I mean, building stopped.
I was doing whatever I could, delivering pizzas. Making ends meet was a hard thing to do, you know? This is my trade. This is what I'm trained to do. Seeing this come back, you make a living wage doing this, you know?
Construction is a virtuous cycle. Guys like Checkitz can go out to dinner or even buy a new truck because lawyers and nurses and small business owners are buying new homes again.
You know, Boise's very fortunate. Boise's growing.
I'm getting the downtown construction crane skyline tour from Bill Connors. He's head of the Boise Metro Chamber of Commerce.
20-story high-rise going up over here on Zions Bank, and then a big project for the Simplot Corporation.
Connors says companies like this place and its laissez-faire business climate.
You know, last year we lowered corporate income taxes and individual income taxes. Not too many states are doing that right now.
What's happened here in Boise, unemployment dropping from nearly 9.5% to just over 6%, isn't miraculous. It's steady growth of a diversified economy fueled by low interest rates, high technology, local talent. It helps to have a corporate heavyweight to anchor that growth. The 800-pound Fortune 500 gorilla here is Micron Technology, one of the top chip makers on the planet.
This is what we call the subfab. So we're underneath where the R&D manufacturing is occurring. You've got the gas sources, the power sources, the drains that are involved, all of that.
Micron just spent millions to build this new global research and development center. Everyone's running around clean rooms in bunny suits. This place will pump lots of money into the local economy and attract super educated scientists from Stanford and MIT. But Micron only employs around 5,000 people in Boise now. It used to employ 10,000. The company downsized in the recession, laying off thousands of high-paid production workers and managers. Hewlett-Packard did the same. Again, Bill Connors of the Chamber of Commerce.
And what's interesting is a lot of people didn't want to leave, so they started up their own little startups here in town.
That is a well-made wine, sir.
One example, a cluster of new urban wineries that have opened in a cavernous Boise warehouse. Winemaker Melanie Krauss was born and raised in Boise, then learned her trade at Top Flight Wineries on the West Coast. She had three criteria for coming home to start a business and a family.
One was that I had to feel that I could make world-class wine here. The second was business climate. The third was lifestyle, and the lifestyle here is great.
Krauss's husband, Joe, used to be a chemist at Micron. Then came the great downsizing. Now he sells wine in the tasting room.
I mean, I saw sideways, but I know bad wine. I'm not sure I know good wine.
This is a dry Viognier, so you should have a bright, aromatic white wine, but it's going to finish crisp.
So another sound of success? Local wine being poured at hip downtown restaurants packed with prosperous urban professionals. Living it up, spending again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
What unemployment looks like in your state and how that compares to the rest of the country is just one of the things you can see on the map at our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up,
fall is your serious period. Your fall and your winter is when, you know, things that matter to the studios from a prestige standpoint begin to be released.
Strategizing the Oscars. But first, let's do the numbers. You knew it was going to be the happy music, right? I mean, come on, the super duper happy music. The Dow Industrials up above 14,000 today. 14,009.79 to be exact for the first time since October 2007. The big board raced up 149 points, more than 1%. The NASDAQ gussied up 36 points, 1.2%, 3179 at the bell. The S&P 500 put on 15 points, 0.5%, broke the tape at 1513. For the week gone by, the Dow picked up 0.8%. The NASDAQ rose 0.9%. The S&P 500 added 0.7%. Financial stocks led the charge. Investors deposited 3.4% today in Bank of America. Morgan Stanley saw a gain of 3.1%. Shares of Citigroup cleared the 2% mark. Shares of Tyson Foods fattened up 3% today after the meat processor beat its earnings forecast. Dell digitized itself a gain of nearly 3% on word the computer maker is close to a buyout. We'll be following that one on Monday. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.02%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases factory orders for December. Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Alice Cooper turns 65. And Snow White and the Seven Dwarves open in theaters across the country on February 4th, 1938.
Magic mirror on the wall. Who is the fairest one of all?
Who cares? You live in a castle and you're wicked. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The 16th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States celebrates its 100th birthday on Sunday. And as amendments go, it's not the most memorable or the most poetic. It is only one sentence, just 30 words. But in those 30 words lies the government's power to levy the income tax. And it turns out that even 100 years ago, the question of who ought to pay what was a big one. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Tracy Samuelson has more.
The 16th Amendment may be turning 100, but the American income tax is actually even older.
The real beginning is in the Civil War, when there was an income tax in place for, most people don't realize this, almost 10 years.
Charlotte Crane is a law professor at Northwestern University. She says when the income tax ended, lots of people actually wanted it back, because without it, the government was raising money mostly through tariffs or taxes on imports. Crane says they hit the poor and middle class harder than the rich. So a permanent federal income tax was created in 1913, a breezy 15 pages. But actually, not many people had to pay it.
It may have affected something like 2% of Americans.
Carolyn Jones is a law professor at the University of Iowa. She's bringing cake to her class next week to celebrate the anniversary.
It was clearly a soak the rich kind of tax. It wasn't viewed as a major source of federal income.
The top tax rate was only 7%. Just a few years later, it ballooned to 77% to pay for World War I. Joe Thorndike, the director of the Tax History Project, says it wasn't until World War II that the income tax started to look like it does today.
Because that's when the tax is transformed from a class tax on the rich to a mass tax on the middle class.
If the income tax has changed over time, one thing's been largely consistent. The questioning of who should pay how much. What is someone's fair share? Sound familiar? In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The real estate market seems to finally be rebounding a little bit. Prices are up, interest rates are still down, which means Sunday afternoons are stacking up with open houses. Marketplace's Jim Burris reports that is welcome news to those who make a hobby of taking a peek at their neighbors' digs.
Real estate agent Sylvia Mallarino is hosting an open house in Atlanta's upscale Briarcliff neighborhood. It's been a good afternoon.
We had one kind of drive-by. But out of five or six parties come through, only one has been sort of what we call a looky-loo.
That's real estate speak for those who drop into an open house but have absolutely no intention of buying.
Are you looking for yourself or
we're just kind of wondering around, thinking about it.
Take 37-year-old marketing consultant Stephanie James.
I think once you get in the habit of it, it's a hard habit to break.
James says she steals peeks inside homes for sale as often as every weekend.
Wow.
On a recent Sunday, I tag along as she checks out this 5,500-square-foot home listed just shy of $1 million.
I didn't know you put urinals in residential homes. I think maybe because there's a pool table down here, it's a man cave.
James doesn't think her hobby of the past 12 years is any big deal. She laughs that she's a tad bit nosy in that stereotypical Southern kind of way. Upon entering the huge kitchen, Stephanie comments how she likes the intricate faux-finish cabinetry and the antique-looking stove. She's not a fan of the lion heads carved into the kitchen sink.
You know, you wash your hands there and you put stuff down the disposal. I don't think I would spend the money to rip it out, but then you wonder if I did rip it out, could I sell it on Craigslist? Is there someone out there that might actually want this?
Part of the fun of an open house for Stephanie is looking at a home's decor and imagining the lives of the people who live there.
And then I think secretly you wonder, why are the people leaving? Because this looks like it's custom to them, probably built for them. So then I think there's part of you that starts to do the soap opera thing of, I wonder if there's an issue or a divorce or, you know, somebody gets transferred. So you kind of wonder about the why a little bit.
Stephanie says she always tells the listing agent she's just looking. But Emory University psychologist Nadine Caslow says looky-loodom can go too far.
I actually talked to a looky-loo this morning, somebody who I knew was one, and I talked to her about it. And it was interesting because her family views her as a looky-loo, but she doesn't view it that way at all.
Caslow says the person in question visits open houses every Sunday and is being treated for what she calls a confluence of psychological issues. But Caslow acknowledges we all have a bit of a healthy, voyeuristic looky-loo quality in us. Need proof? Just ask the millions who tune in every night to HGTV's House Hunters. Kathleen Finch is the network's general manager.
Who doesn't like to look in the windows of their neighbor's home and not be caught?
Finch says the concept is so popular, the network is developing more shows along the same line. For open house enthusiast Stephanie James, she's seen both sides of the coin. When her house was on the market a year ago, her agent said her Sunday open house attracted what the agent described as, quote, curious neighbors.
And then they would make comments to me that, oh, wow, I'd never been in your house before, but then you had an open house, and it's really nice in there. And these are people I didn't even really know. It was a little weird.
Are you familiar with the term looky-loo?
I am not. But looky-loo to me sounds really negative. I hope I'm not.
I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
As you consider your weekend plans, allow me to suggest dinner and maybe a movie, because it is Oscar season after all. By most accounts, a pretty good Oscar season at that, which of course means it's a good season for the studios that make those movies. Wesley Morris is the film critic at Grantland. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
So why is this such a good year?
Not to be too cynical about it, but I think that the business has changed enough for these studios they release fewer movies. And so now I think a lot of what they're doing is strategizing. Fall is your serious period. Your fall and your winter is when, you know, things that matter to the studios from a prestige standpoint begin to be released. And a movie like Lincoln, for instance, it's an Oscar movie that the studio knows is the one movie that it's got that is guaranteed to get everyone's attention. I mean, the odds of its winning Best Picture are pretty high.
Let me ask you then, Wesley, how you explain something like Hansel and Gretel, which is out now and is doing really well. And come on, man.
How do you explain Hansel and Gretel? I think that the studio knows that movie was a mistake, and they wait until what is conventionally known as the January dumping ground, where all these movies that nobody allegedly is looking, or when nobody's expecting a movie to be good, but they need a movie to see. So, and Hansel and Gretel is just that kind of movie. I'm sure Jeremy Renner might want to be embarrassed that he's in that, but you know what? The movie's a hit, and he probably got paid pretty well.
Along those lines, though, I mean, are we now doomed to a bunch of big movies in the summer time based on comic books, and then having Oscar contenders shoved down our throats in November and December, and that's the movie business?
That is, I'm afraid to say, that's the movie business, which is why something like Beasts of the Southern Wild is a real change of pace and like a breath of fresh air and like a reminder that, you know, there is an occasion for lightning to strike or magic to happen. But yeah, I mean, we're basically looking at a pretty predictable releasing pattern for all the seasons, unless some really brave studio executive decides to shake things up by doing something interesting every once in a while to keep audiences on their toes.
Yeah, and the odds of that, right? Some brave studio executive risking, you know, a couple hundred million dollars? right?
And their job, yeah. Odds are pretty low.
Yeah. But, you know, even as we talk about this, though, I'm reminded that 60 years ago, people were saying, oh, well, television's going to kill the movie business, and here we have a multi-bazillion dollar industry still.
Yeah, I mean, that paranoia wasn't unjustified. It was just extremely paranoid, Seth. I'm going to botch the expression, but I mean, you know, you're not paranoid if somebody's after you, and TV kind of was after the movies. But what the movies, you know, at this point, everybody owns, you know, about six people own everything.
Yeah.
So, or six companies own everything. So, I mean, whatever money they're not making at the movies, they are certainly making in TV.
Wesley Morris, he's a film critic at Grantland. Wesley, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a little now and then, sending us into the weekend with some context for Dow 14,000. The last time the blue chips were this high, October 2007, October 12th to be precise. Turns out Beyonce was in the news back then, too. Her song Irreplaceable was number one that year. Ryan Gosling, too. He's in Gangster Squad now. As you know, you've probably seen the ads. Back in 2007, his film was Lars and the Real Girl. So some things don't change, but times were actually different. The unemployment rate back in October 2007, as Lee was talking about earlier, 4.7%. Apple shares 5 years ago closed at about $160-something dollars a share. And, you know, after that, the bust. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on a Friday. Today, the Dow raced up 149 points, more than 1%, 14,009.79 the number. The NASDAQ gussied itself up 36 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 put on 15 points. That is 1% on the nose. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yor is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, Dependence and Debt.
Whether it be drugs or gambling or alcohol, that was a way to cope with life. And then you remove that from the equation and someone's getting sober and now you have a scenario where they're trying to fill their void with other things. And a lot of times it comes in the form of spending.
I'm Kai Rizdal. We're back on Monday. Same bat time, same bat channel. Have yourself a good weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.